The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Mark Amtower of Amtower and Company, which is entirely responsible for its content.
This is Amtower Off Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark Amtower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. Amtower Off Center with your host, Mark Amtower.
Welcome to Amtower Off Center on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. I am Mark Amtower, and I'm here today with a guest who should be here more frequently, Stan Krecci. I met Stan at the Tower Club several, probably a couple decades ago, and he's a mainstay there. He's on the board of governors at the Tower Club, but his expertise is building boards for small companies. Stan, welcome back.
Thank you. Delighted to be back with you, Mark.
I suggest you find Stan at LinkedIn. K-R-E-J-C-I is the last name, Stan Krecci. And find him there, look him up, connect with him, and then seek his advice. Because what we're going to talk about today, especially for small companies, can, especially in the environment we find ourselves, can be life-saving for small business. So, Stan, tell people in your own words what you do, please.
I build corporate boards principally for entrepreneurial companies, so the mid-tier and smaller that have never had either an advisory board or a voting board of directors. The focus initially for entrepreneurial companies is on advisory boards, because there's no threat of control issues with the entrepreneurial founder. And an advisory board, the way I like to build them, is they are developed and run as if they were voting boards of directors. They do everything but vote. So there is a discipline associated with serving on an advisory board of directors. They're not just there as a advisory board for business development. These are advisory boards for corporate management and strategic planning, growth, fiduciary responsibility.
Okay. Now, the business, when you were here the last time, the sequestration thing had really just hit. Verbally it hit, but physically it had not hit. So we're in a perpetual continuing resolution scenario. Sequestration has literally driven down some of the budgets, not insignificantly. Larger companies going after more of that small task order business that they used to hand off. So the climate here really demands that smaller businesses think about other ways they can grow and develop a strategy that takes them to a next level. How does what you do help?
Well, first of all, right now and in the past, the business climate has been very tight. And the awarding, particularly in Washington, D.C., of government contracts has shrunk. And so there is an enormous amount of competition for virtually any contract today, as well as once it's awarded, there's a whole new business that's developing called protest law. And it seems to me that that is an interesting focus that particularly big companies are taking, and even
they can afford it.
Yes, but it almost seems as if they, when they submit their contract, they're also preparing for a protest. And a protest enables particularly small businesses to keep performing until the issue is resolved at the governmental level. But the environment right now is still very iffy. It's hopeful. The new administration supposedly is planning to make some significant investments in defense, which is one of the biggest contract areas.
Yeah.
And in infrastructure development. So there are enormous possibilities looming out there. And of course, small businesses have an initial ability to enter into those contract arenas because of their size and the various programs that are like the set-asides for small businesses. Mm-hmm. So it gives an individual who has a very creative idea an opportunity to begin to develop a new company. So for me, the important thing is that the entrepreneurial founder has to have a lot of energy and has to be focused on growth, stability, and a good management team. And it's sort of at that point when they reach a certain size in the 5 million plus range that they feel confident enough, the entrepreneurial founder, to reach out and surround themselves with people who are maybe brighter, better, more experienced than they to help them move to the next strategic growth level.
Okay. Let me throw out a few issues facing small companies and tell me where a board might be beneficial. First of all, the pipeline.
The pipeline, obviously, for all businesses is extremely important. And so often the small entrepreneurial company is focused on its existing contract, which really helped it get started. And then they sort of begin to add on to that base. So pipeline development and management is crucial to the success and growth of a small entrepreneurial business. And having the right person to help develop that pipeline is crucial to a company. Oftentimes, the entrepreneurial founder, he or she themselves, are not skilled in business development. They've developed the product or service. They have other skills. So they need to surround themselves with people who know how to build a pipeline, particularly in this environment, the Washington, D.C. environment.
Yeah, and pipelines for products and services are different. And we're seeing migration from companies traditionally selling products to try to do more of the service side. And when they're in that migration process, would adult supervision be beneficial?
Well, I think the focus of an advisory board of directors, and I say advisory board of directors dash governance, is that the entrepreneurial founder, who is the inside director, is surrounded by independent directors who have no relationship to the company other than they're going to be serving on the board. And they bring with them the experience to help guide the entrepreneurial company in new directions or analyze where they are and make changes so that they become more efficient and effective in achieving those strategic growth objectives. So a board made up of independent directors probably are the only people in the company that are going to tell the entrepreneurial founder the real truth about what's happening in his or her company.
Yeah. And part of your answer there anticipated the next category of issues, and that's the operations side, the back-end business, including the hiring, et cetera, recruiting.
That's a good point, Mark. One of the things that I think is very important is that when a company is ready to build a board of directors, and I sit down with them, for example, we talk about where are the holes in their organization. And those holes could be in business development, financial management, or operations management. How do I more efficiently and effectively run the business? That's not my skill set. My skill was developing the product or service. So with whom do I surround myself? And one of the wonderful things that an advisory board can do is to, if we define an operations management seat, is bring in somebody who's already walked the walk and helped a company organize itself for success.
Okay. When you're advising companies directly on this, if they're smaller than, say, 50 or so people, or even a little bigger than 50 or so people, do you ever recommend outsourcing a significant portion of that back-end stuff to companies like Insperity?
The answer is yes, because I think it's a very efficient way of using resources, i.e. monetary resources, by not bringing full-time staff on board to do things that sometimes are just needed on a piecemeal basis. Mm-hmm. So outsourcing sometimes your financial shop, your HR shop, makes sense.
Okay. And the last issue I want to talk about is the competitive issue. Do companies differentiate enough to be competitive in what they do? How do your advisors help them in that arena?
I think that is a very important issue, competition. How does one differentiate one company from another. And it requires, first of all, knowledge of your marketplace. Who is in the market at the present time? What products or services are they marketing and selling? And so you can build a strategy around that that is different and unique compared to the other companies that are out there. So it requires, and sometimes the outside directors have had experiences doing that, so they bring the insight to the company to help them clearly see through sort of the fog of what's next and clarify it and narrow it down so that they can focus in a significant way, both resources, money, and people on marketing their product or service.
Yeah, use what you have to maximum benefit and outsource other stuff.
Yes.
Cool. We're going to take our first break. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Lots more to come with Stan Creche. Look him up on LinkedIn, Stan, S-T-A-N, but Creche, K-R-E-J-C-I. He is there, more than happy to connect with the right companies. And he doesn't deal exclusively in the government market. Is that right?
That's correct.
That is correct. So if you're not a government contractor and you're listening, you need a board, you can still call him. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm here with Stan Creche. Here's another way to reach Stan. Stan.Creche, K-R-E-J-C-I, at gmail.com. Stan, so we're kind of primarily talking about boards of advisors here, but please outline the differences between a board of advisors and a board of directors.
There are two types of advisory boards of directors. One is an advisory board dash business development and an advisory board dash governance. And I focus on building advisory boards dash governance because they are run most like voting boards, which I'll talk about in a minute. Advisory board dash business development really is building a group of people, bringing a group of people together to help develop business rather than
lead focus. Lead generator.
Right. Lead generators, opening doors, and so on. I think that should be an essential part of any board member's responsibility, but not solely focused on developing business. In fact, in most cases, they should be back in their own companies developing business for themselves, but giving advice and opening doors. So an advisory board dash governance, the way I develop them, they're run as if they were voting boards. They have independent directors, they have committees, they have strategic projects, they have agendas, they have board books, they have a discipline associated with making a contribution to ensuring the financial viability of a company. A voting board of directors is required for all publicly traded companies, and they do, each member of the board has a vote. And if you have five independent directors and one insider, the five independent directors can frankly overrule the inside director in a voting board. Smaller entrepreneurial companies can go either direction. But I think that for the initial board experience for an entrepreneurial company is to start with an advisory board of directors dash governance because it's quote unquote not threatening to the entrepreneurial founder. He or she can listen to the advice that the independent directors are giving and decide whether to accept it or reject it.
Okay. So what are the telltale signs, the road signs for businesses that they should start considering assembling a board of advisors?
Some of the criteria that I suggest to companies, one is financial, where are they in terms of revenue generation? And it makes sense for a company that probably is in the $10 million range or larger because they have free cash flow and they can afford to pay a director. And we'll talk about compensation later. But that's one criteria. How big are you? Number two, you're beginning to see that your original staff is not meeting your expectations. They've sort of, to use the old phrase, Peter Principling out. And so it's time to surround yourself with people who have already walked the walk to growth. So let's say you're a a $20 million company and you want to grow to 50 or 75 or 100 million, you want to bring on board directors who've already walked that walk. So they have either built and or work for companies that have generated at least five times your revenue, your current revenue base. So if it's 50 million, they've worked for businesses that have that generate $250 million of a business or more. You have to know what are the roadblocks or what are the detours that you're going to be exposed to as you develop the business. And by surrounding yourself with people that have walked that walk, it helps you make decisions, number one, more quickly, number two, more cost effectively, and as a result, action can be taken and generally in the revenue production arena, and that's all good for the company.
Okay. So give me the next step for these people. I mean, I think the knee-jerk reaction usually is something akin to, well, I know this guy over here. He looks relatively successful. I should talk to him. And then there's my brother-in-law who runs a company.
Exactly. Well, I'm a great believer, first of all, in working with the company to define what I call the duties and responsibilities document. What does the company expect of its board members, and what should the board members expect from the company, number one. Number two, I sit down with the entrepreneurial founder, the CEO, chair, and we talk about what holes they have in their current organization. Do they need somebody with stronger financial management skills or MarCom skills, technical skills, strategic planning skills? And so then once we've made a list of the people that we're looking for, and from a seat definition perspective, I write that document so that when I'm looking for candidates, I will be looking for a candidate who meets, let's just take a financial management seat, who has the requisite financial management skills to help a company move to its next growth objective. And then have they worked for a company five times bigger than that so that they know what to expect? How do you make decisions as you move forward in your growth stream? So defining the seats is very, very important. And that means you're starting to surround yourself with people who have greater expertise, experience, and experience than you do in certain areas. You may have developed the product or service, but now you're sort of at a loss is how do I grow the infrastructure around that product or service?
Yeah, you and I have both known a lot of people over the years who have great technological expertise, have written software, whatever, and started a company, and then it plateaus relatively early. But you know, your comments there brought up one thing. You're asking the entrepreneur where their holes are. Can that be myopic, or are you doing due diligence on the side to make sure that you know where the rest of the holes are?
The answer is yes. Due diligence is very important. It's not only talking to the CEO, but if I'm able to talk to some of the other C-suite people who are surrounding the current CEO or entrepreneurial founder. And by the way, to come back to your question, who should be on the board? If you use the seat definition concept, you're going to look for people that bring the skills and talents that you need. The most important thing for an advisory board or a voting board of directors is to have truly independent directors, i.e. you may know of them by name because you've read about them in the papers or you've met them somewhere, but they are not close associates of yours. They are not beholden to the company because you want to surround yourself with people who will give you honest advice, feedback about the direction that you're going. So the no's. Who shouldn't serve on a corporate board of directors? Family and friends. One insider only. Two.
One insider only being the entrepreneur.
Yes. Okay. And I generally suggest that they not bring a finance person on board or a legal person on board unless they're so different from their currently hired legal counsel and accounting firm. So that you can always invite them. They're already on your payroll. You can invite them to any board meeting. I also say no to academicians unless they have started a business, are now teaching at in some business school program, because they have a reality. There's reality there. It's not book learning. It's real experience.
But what if they're academic and they're consultants too?
Well, they can be that if they've really done it and they can show me their track record of success of their consulting practice, that it has helped a company move to its next growth level. So I also am not wild about always having military on just because they're military.
Yeah. Hold that thought. Let's pick that up on the other side of the break. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'll be back with Stan right after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm here with Stan Krejci. Stan was just talking about adding somebody military to the board, and I didn't want him to start in the last segment. I want to flesh this topic out a little bit. So, and it happens with alarming frequency, and sometimes it's good, and other times maybe not so good.
I agree with you, Mark. I have, in addition to my board practice, I do career and transition consulting, and I have on the consulting side, the career side, I have a program called the Civilianization of the Military, where I actually work mostly with generals and admirals, some Navy captains and colonels, to help them translate their careers, 30, 40-year careers, into something that is marketable in the corporate world. Having a star on your shoulder is no longer the dominant decision-making factor. It's really process. And it's not whom you know, because it changes so quickly, as we know, in every agency in the Department of Defense, civilians as well as military are constantly changing. But it's the process. So if they can bring a skill, i.e. they are experts at supply chain management, great skill. If they are comfortable in knowing how to open doors at the Pentagon or on the Hill, what committees to talk with. It's the process. They know where to go. And generally, when they open that door, the civilian might not be there that they worked with or the military that they work with. However, there is some GS individual there who's really running the office, who's there, and will help them be introduced to the new leadership. So it's process. So it's really skill that I'm looking for. Leadership is not the dominant skill, but it is an important skill. But the dominant skill is something significant that is transferable to the corporate world. So there is value there from that perspective. But just having somebody on your board because they are an admiral or general is okay if you want to have somebody like that, because it lends credibility to your organization and what you do.
Window dressing?
Yes. Well, that's you could say it that way. And it's interesting because their value sort of depreciates, whereas if quickly. But if they are skill-based, their value is actually enhanced, and they become even more important part, because now they can put together the entire picture of the corporate world, how does it fit into, let's say, the government contracting world? And so they become a very valuable asset because they know that process. They have a skill that is understandable in the corporate world.
What about former appointees, so CIOs or, you know, the administrator of the Office of Federal Procurement Policy? All of these are appointed positions, and they carry a certain amount of cachet with them, but what would determine extraordinary value there to bring them on either as a board member or a senior staffer?
Again, it is, what is your dominant skill? What skill do you bring? You may be the head of an agency or a deputy or an assistant secretary. It's a skill that you bring, and it's a skill that is not just as a result of your being appointed to that job. It is a skill that's been inculcated in you for quite some time, or grown. It's an accretive skill, and that's what people are looking for. So there is value there. I also work with retiring GSs and SESs, because they, and some sub-cabinet individuals, because they do have important skills. And it again comes back around to, it's not whom do they know, but how does the government react to when you're opening a door or looking for a contract or calling because you have a problem. You know where to go.
Okay. So let's talk about the compensation issues. So you're assembling this board, and these people, while they may do it out of the goodness of their hearts, they are there to make a living as well. And you're really tapping into, if you assemble this right, an extraordinary barrel of experience that you would not otherwise have access to.
That's correct, Mark. And I am a great believer that board members need to be compensated, cash compensation. It can go beyond that with stock options or phantom stock or whatever, but those are really worth zero until the triggering event happens within the company. So it's cash compensation that I think is very important. The company needs to have to strike a check every quarter or every month. The company needs to get value for those dollars that they're spending. And an individual won't and shouldn't be on a board just because they feel good about it or just purely for the stock unless they have such a deep an abiding interest in the company and its product or service, plus they have resources that are enable them to do it, chance that it's going to be a successful business. But I'm a great believer in compensation. And from my perspective, there's I use the $20,000 a year minimum as fair compensation for very small entrepreneurial companies. The bigger the company in terms of revenue, the greater the annual retainer, and also the greater the benefits that accrue to board members as well. But I think that a company needs to understand that these people are working for them and that they have expectations from these board members. So for example, you pay somebody nothing, and you have an upcoming board meeting, but they have an opportunity to do something that's going to generate some cash. Well, where do you think they're going to go?
Right.
And so they don't give it the importance that they should. So the companies that I work with, I make them put together their board meeting dates 18 months out so that the board member can build his or her own schedule around those dates, because generally speaking, companies should only allow their board members to telephonically call in maybe once or twice during a given year. So they want attendance. There's where the synergy begins, when you have all of those board members together in the boardroom addressing issues that are important to the company.
Okay. So that brings up an obvious question. How frequently should a board meet? And the subsequent question is, how do they hold the entrepreneur's feet to the fire on issues that the board deems critical?
There are lots of theories about how often a board should meet, but entrepreneurial businesses who really need that kind of quality advice, at least every other month, I think, is an important time. And whether it's a 3 or 4 hour meeting, generally at the end of the day, because people can then leave their office.
On-site or off-site?
It can be on-site. And then after the meeting is over, they generally should take the whole board out for dinner, invite some of their other C-suite people to join them. And that the meeting still goes on. But you're getting to know each other in a more social environment versus a boardroom environment. So maybe 6 times a year for an entrepreneurial company. Some companies only do it quarterly. The meeting lengths vary. The time of day varies. But I think it's important for companies to set those dates in stone. And as I tell my client companies, make sure when you're setting these dates, you got family, birthdays, anniversaries, trips, all considered and taken care of before you send the schedule out. Because if you change and you do it a lot, the board members begin to lose interest because they're expecting it to be on a certain date and it's not. Now you've suddenly changed it and everybody's scrambling.
Well, it's also reflective of your business philosophy. You can change these dates. You're liable to change company directions without really telling the board.
Exactly. And then in between board meetings, Mark, it's very important for the entrepreneurial CEO chair to remain in touch with his or her board members. And I suggest to them that they send out a every 2 week sort of email about what's happened, good and bad, to the company over that period of time, new employees or contract wins or losses, and that they also meet each quarter one-on-one with each board member so that they really get to know the board member beyond the boardroom, and that they are on call 24/7, basically. If an issue comes up, the entrepreneurial founder can pick up the phone and say, "Hey, John, how would you handle this problem, this okay. issue?"
We're going to take our last break. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio. I'm here with Stan Krejci. You can find Stan or reach out to Stan via email at stan.krejci, K-R-E-J-C-I, at gmail.com. I suggest you do so, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm here with Stan Krejci. Stan advises small and medium-sized companies on putting together boards of advisors and boards of directors?
Yes.
Both. So, but we're focusing primarily on the board of advisor scenario for non-public companies. And I have Stan here because I really think that a lot of companies, most companies of a certain size, would benefit from this. So something you got to consider. So Stan, when we've gone through the process of assembling a board, you're having your first meeting. The first couple of meetings, you start to understand the full scope of what the business issues are for this company. So you come up with a master list, and what do you do from there?
Let me just backtrack for one quick minute, Mark, and that is before a director accepts the call, I like the company to put together what I call the duties and responsibilities document, which outlines the expectations that the company has for the board members. And that includes what they're going to do on a regular basis, but also they might serve on committees and what are those committees. I ask the companies to put together what I call a strategic project list so that they might have two or three items on that list that they want a short-lived committee to focus on during the course of the board year. So there are activities that they know are going to come. In addition, they get a board book, they get an agenda, and that agenda outlines the direction in which how the board meeting is going to move forward. And a critical part of that agenda is the strategic planning process. Where is the company? The financials, employment issues, growth issues, all sorts of factors are on that agenda and in that board book, so that the company, when it's meeting, will discuss these issues in a logical fashion, that the outcome of which should help ameliorate a problem and help the company move forward at a faster pace. I always remember one CEO telling me that after he had his board, he said, "My decision-making process increased exponentially because I was surrounded by people who gave me the confidence to say, why are you procrastinating about making a decision? It's a simple decision. Do it." And I would have anguished, as he said to me, about it for weeks, sometimes months, and they're telling me in 30 seconds, do it.
Yeah, they lose sleep. They're you know, big bags under the eyes because they can't make a decision.
These people are team members for you, the entrepreneurial founders. These are people who are available to you to talk about the most intimate aspects of your business in the most confidential way. And they will give you honest and true advice that will be of benefit to the company in moving it forward at a faster, more cost-effective clip.
Okay, let me throw a scenario at you that I ran across recently. A company has been in business for a number of years, mid-sized company, 150 50, 200 employees. Their primary business has been network infrastructure. So they're excellent and great at maintaining legacy systems. They know that this is a sunset gig, but it's the federal government. So this sunset is not even on the horizon yet. But they want to start migrating to an area where they have no name recognition. They may have some experience, but so what? How does a board? I'm not asking you for specific things here, but how does a board advise in a situation like this?
Well, first of all, the board members have to know the company well as it currently exists and what are its products and services. And I think a logical question that board members are going to ask is, how do we capitalize on this base of product or service? And is there a finite end to it? And if so, how are we going to begin to develop ancillary or complementary services or products that can take us to the next level of growth rather than letting the company sort of fade away? So, and that's always often a problem with entrepreneurial founders. They have one product idea or one service idea and that's it. But if they surround themselves with people who are looking for new ideas, new thoughts, it doesn't mean you're going to adopt them, but it means that you're considering them and you're going to be able to evaluate them and integrate them into your current structure. And if you do that in a logical way, then that gives you the opportunity to do the strategic planning, which includes marketing and all of the other ancillary aspects of developing a new product, whether it's bringing in more technologists or other human capital requirements are needed. So it's a teamwork effort to move a company forward. Now, if the entrepreneurial founder is ready to throw in the towel, that's also an issue because if there's no value going to accrue over time, they're not going to have an attractive enough multiple that'll make it interesting enough for somebody to buy the business from you. So you really do have to be...
Sperry Univac's not there to pick up the pieces anymore.
That's right. You have to have that pipeline of existing and or about to be introduced new products and services to give value to your business.
Okay. So we have about 4 or 5 minutes left. Very simple. How do people get started? I mean... So we've outlined a number of scenarios here, but let's say somebody calls you and, you know, scenario, a 40-person company, revenue stream, 8 to 12 million, fluctuates a little bit, but relatively steady. Walk me through that initial call and next steps.
Well, when somebody calls me, I consider this fact that they have begun to think that they can welcome outsiders to come into the company to help provide additional guidance and direction. They've made a huge step. They are no longer, they are willing to let go of total and complete control. So that's the first step. Are you ready to surround yourself by people who conceivably could be brighter, smarter, and more experienced than you in various skill set areas? So then when they do that, I always want to sit down and meet them face to face and talk to them about what they are looking for in a board of directors, why they want that board, and what value do they see. And then once I have some feeling for what they're thinking, what their beliefs are, it's then I talk about how we can address those particular issues. And with every company, it's different. But it is important to listen and listen carefully to the entrepreneurial founder before you even begin the process. And once we begin the process, if they decide to go ahead, it's about a 4 to 6 week, once a week meeting to delve into every aspect of what's going to happen once we decide we're going to build that board. The duties and responsibilities, the seat definitions, the recruitment process, the interview process. And I'm with them the whole way. And I generally even go to the first board meeting to listen in the back of the room how the entrepreneurial founder is running the meeting and then might critique him offline so that they have very strong management leadership skills that they're demonstrating to the board of directors. So it's a long-term process, and it's also a long-term relationship because I meet with them halfway through the first year, towards the end of the year, and going forward, we might have to replace somebody. It's a very detailed process. It is not simply picking up the phone and calling Joe Smith because you met him somewhere. It is vetting these people, making sure that they're strong. And every time I present a seat, candidates for that seat, I might present between 3 and 8 candidates so that they can see that while they may have the same credentials, once they read about them and then bring them in, then the what I want to call the subjective factors start entering into the decision-making process as to whom they might bring in.
Okay. So give me 2 or 3 reasons why people need to call you now.
Great question. One is that they are at that point in their company's life and their own personal life that they are ready and willing to accept some ideas and thoughts about how to take the company to its next growth objective, number one. Number two, if they don't know how to do that and with whom should they be doing it, that's part of the process that I bring is to help them analyze that talent base that they're looking for. And then number three, they can't do it themselves. They should be running their business. And that's the beauty of what I have been doing over the last 20 years is working with CEOs, helping them find the board members, and then in the process and narrowing it down so that they don't have to spend all of their time devoted to developing and interviewing. It's narrowed down. In the meantime, they're running their business, which they should be doing. So it makes it a much more efficient process. So if they're ready for those three factors, it makes sense to at least initiate a conversation.
There you go. Stan, always a pleasure, man. Greatly appreciated.
Thank you very much, Mark.
This is not my day job. If you'd like to discuss your B2G marketing strategy or understand better where and why LinkedIn fits into our market, drop me a line at markamtower@gmail.com. And thank you for listening to Amtower Off-Center.
You've been listening to Amtower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Amtower Off-Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.